Hello. Welcome to House Seats Presents. It's Friday, and it is hot as hell here. I think we're all going to move to Idaho today. It's so hot.
Let's do it.
Keith Thompson.
Yeah.
We have a lively audience out there. Hey, Friday.
Hi.
Everyone got here from the traffic. Thanks, Vegas, for your wonderful roadways today. I have the most incomparable person here, and I have to even have his resume up here while I talk to him because there's so many things that you've done, and there's so many, you know, paths you've crossed with a lot of Vegas performers. We have Keith Thompson in the house today.
Woo!
Yay!
Keith has just finished up, and just really quickly, I want to tell you, at the top of the show, we usually do like a weekend roundup, mm-hmm. but our weekend really hasn't started yet, so we're kind of mm-hmm. going to give you the full half hour, because we saw the show, and we talked about the show actually last Friday, because we'd seen it right before the opening. We saw it the Friday preview before the grand opening on Saturday.
Right.
It's such a fun show, Keith.
Thank you very much.
Oh my gosh. Like literally the hardest part about the show, and I want to see it again, is because there's our seats and yeah. you know, we took the shot in there, but the hardest part about the show is that you miss the jokes if you laugh too hard at the first ones because they come right after the next.
I know. We found that was a lot of the case. Like people would complain, like I really couldn't hear all the jokes because the audience was laughing so hard that they wouldn't stop laughing so I could hear what the next joke was.
Yeah.
I said, I guess that's a good thing.
No, that's an amazing thing. Yeah, right? Well, when a show keeps you, I mean, the thing about it is, you know, when the show keeps you as entertained as it does, you don't even know that it's time for intermission and you're like, oh, it's time to sit for a minute and then come right back and you're just ready for the next act to begin. I mean, it is so well written in that aspect of the humor and you know, just bringing the audience together. And people were so excited to go see it. That's the thing, I think. You know, you really had the audience enveloped very much early on, you know, before the show even started. Like Vegas, when you think about showrooms and the way they're set up, you know, you have the box office area and then you have the concessionary, and a lot of places try to immerse you before you actually go into the show.
Yes.
Which you did. You brought the big potato from Idaho parked out front.
The big potato truck. I mean, it was, wow.
How many tons is that potato?
I don't really know. I just know that it was really large.
Yeah.
And, you know, potato, just as far as it's brown and it's tubular.
Yeah.
It could look like a lot of different things.
It can.
But it was definitely a spud.
Yeah.
And that's actually the official potato truck
okay.
from the state of Idaho.
Oh, okay.
So they invested in, I mean, not invested yeah. in money, but they invested in the whole idea
yeah.
of celebrating their state in such yeah. a way.
So did you have, in that way, in that regard, did you have a lot of dignitaries from Idaho come see the show, knowing that they had a show written about?
Just the people from the potato, what was it, association or something
initiative.
Like that. Yeah, it is.
There is such
like
a thing.
Yeah. Oh,
they guard those very closely.
They take yeah. it very seriously.
We have a little bit of B-roll from the show. Such yeah. a talented cast, too. I know we'll get into that, too. And
oh, yeah.
an amazing score.
Thank you.
But yeah, no, I mean, you had the whole Idaho, put your face in the Idaho kind of thing down in the lobby.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
Right, to have your picture made
yeah.
as that gorgeous woman.
Did I just say put your face in a potato?
No, it was...
Also make Julian Fries.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was her name, Julian Fries, uh-huh. the woman. Who
yeah.
was, no, I have no idea who that was. She was like a model that we got, who actually looked like very much like one of the girls we cast in the show.
Yeah.
So people kept mistaking, hey, you're the girl in the poster.
Yeah.
No, she's not.
She's like, not. Yeah. Well, after we saw the show, it was a group mm-hmm. of us that went to the show. We did go and eat. We did seek out potatoes.
It kind of makes you hungry for them, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. The whole show, you're like, literally, I'm starving.
Yeah.
All I want to do is eat potatoes now. And we went, yeah, we had an amazing meal at Beauty in Essex at the Cosmopolitan. Check it out. It looks like a pawn shop when you walk in, but it's really not.
See?
It's actually a restaurant.
That's very nice.
There you go. So, and we actually had honor over here. Our friend Amy Jo, her husband, took this picture, and it is a heart-shaped potato.
Oh, my God.
Literally, there was nothing more of a prop that I could think of than the, I mean... Here's the thing. Keith has done everything under the sun.
Everything.
And the one prop I bring with me is the potato, because honestly, this is the most prevalent thing right now.
Well, yeah. And we, you know, we as a creative team, went to the state of Idaho and went to the Potato Museum where they have things like this. They, and we went to a potato farm where they have some of the most weird-looking potatoes you've ever seen in your life. And then what they do in the conveyor belts, they pull out the ones that look really odd and strange so that what you see in the store is just the very the best-looking potatoes. It is. And the rest of them are used for like you know, fries at McDonald's and and stuff like that, that you don't ever have to look at the actual potato.
When you were there, I want to ask you this because I've done this before. When I went, the potato in Idaho tastes totally different than the potato in the grocery store. Did you notice that? How fresh that potato was picked right out of there?
I kind of didn't notice, but you're right about that. And it's like kind of like wine. It's like at the vineyard, it tastes so much better than when you get it out from
the
store.
Also, you're in Napa, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's pretty awesome. And so, and it is a huge business. Were there any, what were some of the odd shaped potatoes in the museum? I'd like to know.
Oh, they were, I mean,
this one came out looking like
I can't even
Donald
tell
Trump.
You. There were a lot of them that were, you know, very, can I say this? Phallic.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean the, and,
penis.
Boobular.
Boobular.
Yeah,
that's
were.
A new word I haven't heard before.
Oh yeah,
boobular. Okay,
they were very. It's just those are the odd ones, you know, and the ones that looked like they were like, you know, had like tumors growing off of them and stuff. It was there were, many of them were very ugly, but so that's why they don't want you to see.
They
those.
Don't want to see those potatoes come out of Idaho.
No,
they're very simple people. They don't want you to know what they really grow over there.
But it's amazing. I mean, and the people there were so great and gracious to us and invited us in and really were so proud of what they do. And we took a lot of that away with us.
Yeah.
So that when we were working on this incarnation, we were working with a little bit more of their history and their and like their pride of their industry.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the potatoes, but it was also looking back to the time whenever this the show was set. We wanted to make sure that it was grounded in some truth.
Right.
Because that makes it even funnier.
Yeah. Our one friend we brought with us was from Boise originally.
Oh, so really?
She fact checked you. No, she laughed at a lot. She laughed
I
at a lot.
I think the only thing that we took a lot of license with is apparently there aren't very ever any
tornadoes.
Yes. That's right.
That's the one part. She's like, right. I'm like, well, you know, it's showbiz.
It is.
And I love the tornado scene.
Isn't that funny?
Like, it is the best. This is the best tornado ever. It just wheels into the into the show.
It's just an actor inside that thing turning a little crank. And
That's almost the best way. If you saw like this massive like lighting thing going on, you'd be like, oh, it's just more funny because it keeps with the humor of the show going, oh my God, that's the tornado.
Yeah.
But she did look over us and like, I don't remember when I lived there how many tornadoes we had. I can think like maybe there were this many, but
exactly.
Yeah.
And we know that, but it's more of a spoof on the genre of the musical comedy, which is what we set up from the beginning is we are going to be in the land of musical comedy.
Right.
And what's a good musical comedy without a tornado ballet? So, so that's what
it is. One of the most poignant parts in the show.
It is.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the progression of Idaho as it relates to what you've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll kind of get back a little bit to Idaho, where I want you to kind of tell me how your career progressed to this and how you got introduced to Buddy and how that whole process of collaboration works, because that's something that's really interesting for the viewers, as well as the people. Now, most of the people we interview on the show, we will tell you, you're probably one of the first few sort of behind the scenes. Major parts of a show that we're with. We usually interview a lot of entertainers.
Right,
a lot of people, a lot of people auditioning.
Yeah.
A lot of people going through that process. You're on the other side of the audition process a lot.
You're
listening to
you interview the result and not the source.
Exactly.
So I see what you're saying.
But I think from your perspective, which I think is a really interesting, you have been around a lot of talent in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of people that we've had on the show have been, you know, proteges of shows or ones you're currently in. Travis Clore was one of our very first guests.
Yes.
Nikki Scalera, who was alumni from We Will Rock You, which is where we met.
Mm-hmm.
These performers in town have such a huge respect for you.
Well,
and they love staying here even when their shows, you know, close or whatever happens. They like to stay around Vegas as the talent pool stays around Vegas. So this is one of the reasons why we even have the show and why we talk about, you know, what keeps it alive and what keeps the city moving. And we'll talk about Composer's Showcase that you keep moving along here that keeps the entertainment community binded together.
Yes.
So let's go back in time for Keith.
All right, let's go back.
Let's take you in the tornado back.
Okay.
To to about 12 plus years ago.
All right.
When you showed up to Vegas.
Yes, I showed up to Vegas. I had been on the road with Mamma Mia on the first national tour, and I got a call to come audition for We Will Rock You.
Yeah.
And I really had no intention of coming to Las Vegas because I couldn't imagine.
Right.
You know, it just didn't make any sense to me. I was a New Yorker, period.
Yeah, of course.
But I couldn't pass up the opportunity to come and audition for Queen, or those guys from, the, of course, Freddie Mercury being currently dead.
Right. But Brian May.
Brian May, Roger Taylor. It was just one of those things I had to do. Yeah. And they had also called my partner, Philip Fortenberry, who we do, you know, we're a musical team, and he had been in New York. I was in San Francisco. We came, met, auditioned, and they offered us the job on the spot and had to make a decision really quickly. But we decided, you know, maybe this is what's next.
Yeah.
We weren't spring chickens anymore, and it seemed like maybe this is the next chapter. So we decided to give it a year and see what would happen. And of course, We Will Rock You lasted a year.
Right.
On my way, from the time I got the okay to go ahead and move to Vegas, which is about 3 months before I got here, I was passing through Los Angeles with Mamma Mia, our last stop.
Yeah.
And my old friend, Buddy Sheffield, reached out to me through his ex-wife, who she and I were still in friends, and she said, Buddy needs you to help him write this musical that he's got an idea for.
Oh, wow.
And it was Idaho.
Yeah.
And I went over and we started working together there in LA. And then when I moved over here, he started coming over here and we'd go back and forth. And we found the cast of We Will Rock You. There were some members there who we did a reading. We did the demo.
The demo.
And we put it all together and we realized we had a show.
Yeah.
And so it was a very early version of it. I mean, really, it was a lot more spoofy then, a lot less invested in the characters and their development and their being caring about each other. But at the time, we knew it was funny.
Yeah.
And we knew the music had depth to it. And so that's how that all started. So Idaho is as old as my career in Las Vegas.
Wow.
In other words, for me.
Yeah.
So the very beginning.
And that's how you realize the comprehensiveness of your dream. And when you really put down with somebody who says, I need your talent, I need your help. I have the foresight for something like this to know in my head where I want to take it.
Yeah. And I'd known Buddy so many years ago, back when I first graduated from college. I used to work for his theater company and he wrote comedy. And he was my introduction to comedy writing. So then when I moved on to New York and he moved on out to Los Angeles, that's where we split. But I continued to write comedy in the style that he had taught me with my friend Jay Rogers, who was Uncle Fate in Idaho.
Yeah.
So those relationships are, you know, just ancient.
They're key and they're vital. And I think when you make those first introductions and you make those connections, and that's one of the things that we talk about House Seats when we do our House Seats Presents shows, the set list shows that we do and the things that we do in town, you're really connecting a lot of the performers to do something outside of what they're normally, and then giving them that creative, you know, drive to produce something, to start something. And I think one of the really great things about Idaho that you guys did was actually prove that it can be done, no matter how long it takes to do and how many, you know, words it takes a day for you to write.
Can I tell you how many times people would it's really funny, it's great, you know, but I don't really think it's going to go anywhere. You know, maybe it's time for you to give up on that dream, you know, and those are the words that just challenge me. And I say, you know,
absolutely.
What? I don't think so, because what does it cost you to dream? And to,
are those the naysayers? Fuck them. Fuck them.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's what I did. I mean, it was in the face of that kind of discouragement that we continued to push.
Yep.
And finally, whenever it was just a serendipitous moment 2 years ago, whenever we were in New York doing a reading after many people had said, you know, give up. And Myron Martin happened to be in New York that day and came to the reading. He never really heard it much about it other than a song or two I might have done at the Composer Showcase.
Yeah.
And said, I'm in town. Are you doing the reading today? And I said, yeah, I put your name on the list. Come on, Myron. And he came in and he came up to me at intermission, said, and why aren't we doing this in Las Vegas? And I said, I'm not sure. Why, Myron, why aren't we? And so the conversation began just
there.
Like that.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, then I will give the Smith Center and Myron Martin and Paul Beard complete credit
Absolutely.
For their vision and their belief and their trust in something that they saw potential in and what they have. I mean, they just had faith in us. And so we delivered the product. They did all the right things as far as producing it, I think, correctly.
Yeah.
with investing in a great cast, mm-hmm. just the right amount of production value, not too much, allowed me to hire an orchestra, which just made my heart soar. I had 15 pieces of the best musicians.
They were
in Las
awesome.
Vegas.
And they were just as much a part of the show. For those of you who didn't get a chance to see it, they were actually on the stage where normally they're in the pit or behind and piped in. A lot of times I see when I see Keith conducting, it's from you'll see him a lot.
Yes.
From the video
just
monitors above the
video
theaters
monitor.
At the Paris, you actually have the orchestra on stage and part of the show.
Yes.
And that's even more fun because you actually see the musicians get into the music themselves right on stage. So they're actually part of the cast.
And the hardest part was to keep them from laughing so much that they would miss their cues. it was. And it actually happened a couple of times. I had to catch some of my drummers like, here's a cue. He was like, ah, ha, ha, ha.
Well, and it actually does it make the musician feel a little bit more comfortable too, having them there? It's almost like there's another layer of protection on the stage and you're like, I have the actual musicians on the stage with me. I don't need to worry about, you're right there with them.
Oddly, in Las Vegas, it's not uncommon to see your orchestra on stage, like in Showstoppers or any of the showrooms. They'll put, you have your orchestras on stage. Rarely in New York. I believe, I think it was Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. On Broadway, they actually had an onstage orchestra that was really cool. And they would bring them out and back, and then the set would cover them.
Right.
So it was maybe similar, except for it's a totally different style of show.
Right.
It was that early 60s kind of op art, kind of a fun look. But that was a really interesting thing. I love seeing that with that orchestra on stage.
Yeah.
After Midnight had Wynton Marsalis's orchestra on stage.
Okay.
And I found that to be one of the most compelling reasons to go see that show.
Yeah.
So for this to happen like this, I thought it was a really great idea.
Well, and you've worked on other shows. You worked on Cabaret and Chicago that also utilize musicians in the
stage.
Same way
yeah.
where obviously in Cabaret, they're part of the show.
Oh, they're the actors.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They move set pieces.
Uh-huh. And then they come down, they dance, and then they go up and they play their saxophone or their violin.
Who was you have Cabaret you did in New York?
I did
or
the
on
First
tour?
National.
Okay.
So I did the as soon as it was a hit in New York, they put out the First National. I worked with Terry Hatcher and
she was Sally
Leah
Bowles.
Thompson. She was Sally Bowles. Yeah. And Norbert Leo Butz was my before he was Norbert Leo Butz, he was just this guy named Norbert. And
I think Eiler has a soft spot out there for Norbert.
Oh, he's so talented. Hey. Unbelievable. One of the most talented people I think I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
And, he deserves every bit of success he's gotten because he's just spectacular.
So coming here, and obviously, when you touched on real briefly the audition process with Brian May and Roger Taylor from Queen.
Uh-huh.
I want to first of all know how that audition, because I was part of the audition process for all the actors.
Mm-hmm.
We were brought in as the PR and the help for open calls and things like that. So we saw a lot of the kids come in and audition.
Yeah.
For the parts, but we didn't. Your audition. What is an audition process like for a musical director?
Rarely do we have to do this.
Right.
So this is an odd thing, you know. And you're right. I think the thing was pretty much cast before they even started looking for the band.
Yeah.
What they did was they brought in musicians from all over the country. So rock and roll musicians, people who were in really like name bands and things, or and they brought them in groups and we all played together. I was brought into the final callback because I was not available to come in before that.
Okay.
And I guess because I had theater experience, they needed a musical director for this particular thing that was not just a rock guy, but also had the theater experience as well.
Yeah.
So that's what it was like. I mean, most of my personal thing was more of an interview. I went in and I talked to them, and we talked about people we knew in the common in the business. And it was more of that kind of thing than anything, but they just needed to be assured that I was somebody who was kind of on the same page that they were.
Right.
And I was inside, I was like, oh my God. But outside, I was just really cool. I was like,
sure.
Last time I saw Kathy, and she was, with Sean. And, it was that kind of thing.
It was a name-dropping moment.
It was.
Yeah.
But it was really
cool.
But
in a good way, in a production value way, like, who have you worked with that we respect and admire?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we got to the audition process, and so they put us all in different groups of people, and I was one of the pianists as well.
Yeah.
So that's as soon as the auditions were over, that's when they grabbed me and they offered us the job on the spot.
You and Philip?
Uh-huh.
And Philip is his partner. Now, I want to stress that We Will Rock You was only playing on the West End in London at the time.
That's
this
correct.
Was the first North American show for We Will Rock You. So it was important for Vegas to grasp this national, rather than going to Broadway first, they brought it to Vegas.
Yes.
And
they really wanted to Americanize it a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of references in the London version that, like, about, you know, Wembley and all the things.
Sure.
That,
where they played.
Right. So they changed ours to Graceland.
Yeah.
And underneath Vegas and things like that. They made it more American-centric, and they cut it down to, ours was cut down to 2 hours.
Yeah.
Eventually, we ended up cutting it down to an hour and a half because it was the Vegas formula.
The Vegas format,
and we're trying to make it work as best we could.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about that was that we had a combination in the band of these really top-drawer rock and roll musicians and some theater musicians like me and Philip from New York. Paul Crook.
Paul Crook was the awesome guitar player.
Uh-huh. And he looked just like Billy Idol.
Yeah,
and,
he did.
And so we put that all together, and we had a difficult time at first territorially.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
respect and all that kind of stuff. But it was only a matter of time before we all realized that you do something that you do really well that I don't do. And together we do something that's magnificent. So it was maybe the best, most high-quality band I'd ever worked with.
Right.
And we loved coming to work together.
Yeah.
The high level of respect that we all ended up having for each other. And we're still friends today.
And the musicianship. I mean, there were times, if you had a chance to see the show, it ran for about just over a year at the Paris. There were moments when Brian May would just show up and play.
Yeah.
He would just pop out of the bottom, and he would just play. And you're like, and some people who didn't know Queen, really, I mean, that was the hardest part when we were working on the show. People didn't know that was somebody from Queen. They just thought it was part of the show. It was somebody in costume. You're like, no, that's Brian May.
Yeah.
Playing right now in the middle of our show.
I think that's one of the problems. The interesting things about that show is, or that group, is that we know them as Queen. We know all their Bohemian Rhapsody, thanks to, you know, Bill and Ted's Great Adventure.
Right.
And we know We Are the Champions and things like that.
Basketballs and all those things. Right.
But their history, as far as a group goes, they didn't really enjoy a lot of time here in the United States because of some political anti-apartheid stances they made.
They had a lot of things going on.
Right. And so they ended up mostly being in Europe. So all the footage you see of Freddie Mercury is all from touring Europe and mostly in South America, and not so much in the States.
Right.
So there was a long period of time where we knew their music, but we never didn't.
There we go.
Yeah.
And they have such an amazing sound to them too. Like, it's just, it is. What I loved most about that show, I'm getting goosebumps, just remembering, like, Nikki Scalera and Sean Coey. These are when I met these kids for the first time.
Oh yeah.
Tony, what was our lead?
Tony Vincent.
Tony Vincent. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we had auditioned a lot of people. I remember doing an open call in LA, and I think, oh boy, this was 2005 or 2004 when we started auditioning. And it was right after American Idol had gone through its first couple seasons, and Justin Guarini came in to audition for the lead character.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know who Justin Guarini was because I didn't watch American Idol. Sorry, I really didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. But all these people came in to want to work with the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because the weird dichotomy, and I know we're talking a lot about the show, but the weird dichotomy of the show was it was Queen and Robert De Niro producing the show.
Yes, that's right.
Which was the strangest combination to me when we first started putting it together. Like, what does Robert De Niro want to do with the show?
Yeah.
But it came, I mean, it came out.
Tribeca, I think, is his production company.
Tribeca came in to do the production of the show. And it was just such a fun, like, opening night was just like, it was the most insane.
That party
on the pool.
With every rock and roll musician you think of.
We're outside just showing up and playing and riffing. And half the time, if you didn't really know a lot of rock stars, which I grew up, you know, we were talking before when we did our Van Halen set list. I grew up, my uncle worked for Van Halen for 5 years. And so, you know, there was always a little bit of rock and roll going on. But if you didn't know, I mean, you're just watching the presence of all these people and you're like, Oh my God, who's that? And what is going on now? And if there was a roof, I think that's what the article said. If there was a roof on the Paris pool, it would have been blown off with the talent and the sound that came off that stage.
It is absolutely true.
All these kids have gone on and done great things.
Mm-hmm.
All the kids that we remember who had done that, I think I see Amir Talai on every commercial under the sun. He was on like a movie, What to Do When You're Expecting or something. He was a husband on that. But he's in every like Doritos commercial or whatever. I always told my partner, Jay, I'm like, I know him. That's Amir Talai from We Will Rock You.
Mm-hmm.
They've all gone and done great things here in town and out of town.
Out of town, New York, a lot of them on Broadway.
Yeah.
Will Swenson, you know.
Will Swenson.
That's right.
The Swan Song, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Uh-huh.
And he married...
Audra McDonald.
He married Audra McDonald.
Yeah.
I was sitting there watching Audra McDonald dismiss her with my mom a couple years ago, and she's like, I want to talk about my husband, Will Swenson. I'm like,
Wait a minute.
That good little Mormon boy I used to know from.
That's right.
It's so awesome. Smallest world in the world.
Yes, it is.
Is the performance community. So getting here, We Will Rock You, and then honestly, every laundry list of show that exists right now in Vegas, Keith has been a part of.
Well, for a while it was the strangest thing because the hope was Broadway West was happening and Mamma Mia was a big hit.
Right.
And they were saying, and We Will Rock You's going to run 10 years, you know, and you could retire. And I thought, oh, that's really great.
Yeah.
Well, a year later, they say, we're closing. I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And then they said, but Hairspray's coming the next month.
Yeah.
And so we'll write in. Okay, well, that's great because Hairspray's great. And everybody loves Hairspray, right?
That was over at the Luxor.
Yeah. And Harvey Fierstein was here.
Yep.
And who knows what and why that things happen and they open, they close in Las Vegas because it's a whole different criteria that have to do with bean counters and corporate offices and things like that. So I'm not going to go into
that. We won't go into that, but a lot of that has come out this week. But, you know, it's one of those things that the way entertainment was always built in this town, it was always an amenity to what else they had going on until the Cirque conglomerate and things came in where a show could actually profit from and make this money and have this opportunity to put your property on the map, so to speak, then it became a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, go ahead.
And the corporate model is different than the old mafia or mob mentality used to be, which was you just keep the show running so that you'd have something to invite your high rollers to.
Exactly.
And in this case, it's just very different. Everybody's got all the shows are four-walled, which means that it's the producers that are taking the risk and not the casino.
Right.
Yeah. So,
we don't get into politics.
No. But it's just, it runs a different way. And so that's why I hate for people to say that, you know, like, well, theater's not going to work in Las Vegas.
Hello, Jersey Boys is running for eight and a half years.
So, and Phantom.
That's the longest running, basically, Broadway show here in Vegas is Jersey Boys.
That's our gang. That's me in the middle. Look at that.
And a great, talented cast you have. You've had from Rick Fonio to Eric Bergen, who was in the show for a while. I just saw him when we saw each other at the Smith Center. Amazing.
Yeah.
And now he's on, what's the show called?
Madam Secretary.
Madam Secretary. There you go. Oh, we were getting political again. Sorry.
See? That's a good show. Very
well
written.
It is a very good show. Tay Leone.
And good for him. I mean, Eric really has come into his own, and I'm very proud of him.
Gotcha.
Then after Hairspray didn't last, you know, it lasted about, 4 months total? Right. 6 months if you count from the time we started to the time we ended.
Yeah.
Then there was a little time of like, uh-oh. So I decided to go to wine school. Mm-hmm. And then,
oh, really?
Yeah, because somebody said, you should go do something that you love and you know. And
who doesn't love wine?
Right.
So the first thing he asked me when he walked in before the show was, do you have any Chardonnay? I will remember to bring that next time from DW. We only have hard alcohol here, Keith. We only drink really early on. I'm having potato vodka today, so.
An honor of Idaho.
Scott. No Chardonnay? Come on.
We'll talk about that, Scott.
White wine spritzers.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So while I was in wine school, there was rumors of something called the Producers that was coming.
Yes.
But even before that happened, I'd seen the Tony Awards and the show called Jersey Boys was happening. Uh-huh. And it looked like, I said to myself, that show looks like a good show for Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So I contacted the people that I knew involved with it and said, how do I get in line for the Las Vegas production?
Yep.
And they put me in touch with the supervisor who said, well, there's absolutely no job for you. And and I said, okay, well, mind if I come learn the show anyway? And he said, well, if you want to on your own nickel. And I said, okay, well, that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So I did. I went after it. And after going and you know, flying myself back and forth to New York a few times and putting myself through the paces, he put me on to conduct on Broadway once.
Yeah.
And then after that was over, he said, well, okay, if the Vegas company ever happens, we'll let you know. Don't call us, we'll call you. And then I went off and did the Producers. And somewhere when I was doing the Producers, I got the call that said it's happening in Vegas and you're the man. So all I can tell you is if you've got an idea or you've got a dream, go for it.
Go for
it. Don't tell anybody tell you you're stupid or you're foolish or you can't be done because it happens.
I'm goosing. And I know we have a little bit of time left. One of the things I wanted to touch on with that same exact thing you're talking about is with Jersey Boys and go see it before September
18th.
Composer Showcase is coming up August 10th at the Smith Center Cabaret Jazz Room.
Yes.
Get your tickets now. They sell out fast. There's a quick little snippets of people, Kavanaugh, people that do amazing things and showcase their talent with Keith. I'm seriously goosebumping because I know we have way more to cover with Keith, but less time to cover it.
Okay, that's fine.
But we'll have you back.
Please do.
One of the things I wanted to say about Idaho is this is a show in my opinion, totally destined for Broadway because they're missing that element of a fun show like that where it's literally like Oklahoma, like you say, it's Oklahoma meets Blazing Saddles. It's totally on that vein of like fun.
It's irreverent, but it's really musically, seriously, the quality level is as if we were trying to do Oklahoma,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't take it for granted that it's...
Like Curly. I mean, I totally see it being a movie, too.
I do. I do, too. Very cinematic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
You're awesome. Right. Say hi to Philip for me. Okay. He'll be back again. Have a wonderful weekend, guys. Bye.